The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
This is my first talk at IMC for the year. And as is my custom, I'd like the first talk of the year to be a talk on the Four Noble Truths. And in thinking about the Four Noble Truths, I am reminded that right after the Buddha was awakened, he was asked to teach. And he was somewhat reluctant to teach. But then with repeated requests, he decided he would teach. And in saying he would teach, he declared or said that the doors of the deathless stand open, or the doors of freedom stand open. And this idea of the doors to freedom stand open is an interesting expression. That it isn't that they were open back then and they've shut since. Or it isn't that they're open in India, and if we just get to India, we'll find this big door. And we just can walk through that door, you know, we'll be free. And it isn't that the doors are somewhere in the future. The idea is the doors are open now. They're here and now. For those who know how to find them, to look at them. And what I'd like to suggest is that the doors to freedom can be found in every single event that we encounter, that we live in, that we find ourselves in. So in every event that occurs, there's the doors of freedom for those who have the eyes to see, those who have the ability to step through. And it isn't just one door. There's actually many doors available. There's many Dharma doors available in any given event, any given situation we find ourselves in. So I use the expression event carefully, because I could say in any given thing, anything we see, experience, anything we encounter, but that suggests that it's a thing out there. It's us here, and then there's a world of experiences out there. But when you're talking about an event, you could see that kind of dualistic idea that there's an event out there and me, I have nothing to do with that event. Or we can see ourselves as included in the event. And that's what I meant with using the word event. That we're part of any event that we're part of. So right now there's the event of a Dharma talk, and I'm the one happening to giving it, but you happen to be the people listening to it. But we all share the event in one way or the other. There's the event of the Dharma talk, just, you know, at IMC. There's the, if you leave here and it starts to rain, then there's the rain. You can say, what's the Dharma door of the rain? As if in the rain you'll find, if you kind of get a microscope, you'll find it. Or you can say, what's the Dharma door of the event of the rain? The event is you included. You're in the rain. You have an umbrella or you don't have an umbrella. You have to drive through the wet conditions. So the Dharma door, in order to find the Dharma door, you have to include yourself in the event. You're part of it. Not in some dualistic way, not that you're separate from it, but you're actually inclusive. And so it's very holistic or very inclusive, Buddhist practice, because no matter where you're in, what you're at, any situation you find yourself in, it's a way of turning towards that to find the Dharma. And why that's very important is that we don't find the Dharma normally by turning away, denying, pushing things away. Sometimes we let go of things. There are strategic ways that the freedom is found by letting go, but never turn our back towards anything. Never dismiss anything. This last week I felt a little bit concerned about how easily some of us use the word just. Oh, it's just a thought. Oh, it's just, you know, something. Oh, it's just a feeling. Oh, it's just so and so. It's just Gil. And there might be some wisdom in the word just. We don't take things out of proportion, to make them things more important than they should be. But it's too easy with the word just to actually be dismissive. That, that's not important. And I think that in Dharma practice, we'd like to think of everything as important. And everything is in some ways kind of equal importance as a door to the Dharma, as a door to freedom. Some situations, some events are much more difficult to find the door than others. But still, it's there. And so the task in Dharma practice is to find the door, to find where's the door I can step through, where is it my freedom here, as opposed to running away from the situation, denying the situation. So where is it? So, and as I said, I think there are many doors, many Dharma doors. So it's up to you to find that door. It's for you to kind of attune yourself or perceive or study, investigate situation, any situation you're in, to see where is the possibility for freedom here? Where's the possibility for the Dharma here? Where's the possibility for compassion, for love, for peace, for release? Where's the possibility for deeper understanding of the situation? Where is it? So it requires staying present and looking. And so mindfulness practice is a key to this practice, because one of the functions of mindfulness is to help us be present in a way that's helpful. Not present in some kind of agitated way, but really present in a calm way so that we can actually study what's happening. We can see what is happening here. What's happening in me? What's happening in the world around me? What's happening here so I can find the key for it to be a little bit freer or a lot freer in a situation. This means that in Buddhism, you have a responsibility. And there are, I think, some spiritual traditions, including some Buddhist traditions, where there's a kind of a forfeiture of personal responsibility. It's very comforting to have a religious teaching that says, oh, just put your hands in the hand of Buddha, and Buddha will take care of you, or something like that. That you know, you can just trust something else. But in the teachings that of the Buddha himself, there's a way in which we have to learn to take responsibility. So I like to think of Buddhism as being for adults. And so we're trying to find the inner adult. Sometimes not so easy. So there's many things I can talk about as the pointing to, as being doors. One of the significant doors that Buddhism talks about is the door of impermanence, the constant change of our events, our experience, what's going on in situations. And certainly there can be a kind of a lightening up sometimes when we realize that things are changing. I've been told that there's a Sufi story of a man who went to a Sufi teacher and said, I have this wonderful ring. Can you inscribe something on the ring, some saying that will help me in my spiritual life? And so the Sufi wrote on the ring, this too will pass. And so certainly when you find yourself in difficult situations, to remember, oh, this too will pass, can be helpful. But what about when you find yourself in wonderful situations, blissful situations? You don't want to be told that. This too will pass. I mean, that's kind of like a party pooper. But in fact, bliss will also pass. And you're actually better off knowing it than not knowing it, because then you're not going to cling to it in a way that's going to hurt you later. So that's one door. Another door that Buddhism points to is the door of what can be called not self, or the impersonal door. We don't take things so personally. So in a conventional, colloquial way, not taking things too personally is often talked about, and it seems it can be freeing and helpful. You lighten up if you don't take things too personally. But Buddhism takes it to a kind of more inclusive degree, where we learn not to see anything as being something to define me. Nothing is used to define who I am. So who are you then, if you can't be defined? Well, that's kind of a challenge. And the trick is that if you don't define yourself, and the trick, by not defining yourself, there's a greater opportunity to be free. And so it isn't a matter of finding who you are that's the quest of Buddhism, but it's rather to free you from clinging and holding on to all the definitions, all the ways that we identify, this is who I am. And then what we are can just take care of itself in some way, rather than us needing to hold on to something, cling to something. So in any situation we find ourselves in, what are we taking, how are we defining ourselves in the situation? How are we identifying in the situation? How are we building up our sense of self? How are we measuring our sense of self? How are we comparing ourselves to others in the situation? How is selfing occurring in the situation we find ourselves in? And it can be very, very subtle. It can be as subtle as it starts to rain, you know, during the Dharma talk, and then you realize you didn't bring your rain jacket or your umbrella. You know, it's easy enough to do. But then the thought occurs, well, maybe I should sneak out of here so no one sees how stupid I was. You know, because, you know, there's been a lot of rain and we should have rain jackets. So there's a very little movement. It might not be a powerful source of thinking, but it's a little thought, how other people see me is important here. And I don't want to be seen as someone who forgets rain jackets. So that's a kind of a trite example, but it's pointing to something that's considered a Dharma door to freedom in Buddhism. Another Dharma door to freedom is what's called the Dharma door of suffering itself. And there's a way of paying attention to any situation, any event you're in, and asking yourself, where is the suffering in this event? Where is the tension? Where is the stress in this situation, this event? Generally, you find it in yourself. Sometimes you can feel it interpersonally, or you feel it in some other people, and that's significant as well. But where is the suffering in the situation? And maybe it's counterintuitive to think that suffering should be a Dharma door, that suffering should be an important door. Somehow if you step into or towards suffering, that somehow that's a significant spiritual movement to make. Many of us think that suffering, you know, we recoil from it. We'd rather not be part of it. We'd rather not, you know, really look at it in a responsible, careful way. So one of the ways that the suffering is, in a sense, honored in Buddhism as a Dharma door is that it is sometimes called noble suffering. And the first of the Four Noble Truths is the noble truth of suffering. And now this isn't to celebrate suffering in all its different forms just because it's suffering. Saying, oh, just let's go out and suffer some more then. And what it is there's a way of looking at suffering that is noble. There's a way of looking at suffering where we can find freedom or find the Dharma, or find practice, find the path. So we shouldn't just suffer for the sake of suffering. The whole point of Buddhism, and I should underscore this, the whole point of Buddhism is to really free ourselves from suffering. To have a radical transformation of heart so that our heart becomes free from all the forces within us that contribute to stress, distress, fear, and suffering. And there's a radical release. So that's really the point. So the suggestion is there's a way of paying attention to suffering that can be freeing. Probably most of you here are all too familiar with ways of paying attention to suffering which produce more suffering. Is that fair enough? That you know not to do. But maybe you don't know so well how to pay attention to suffering to become freer of suffering. So the Dharma door of suffering. So the Buddha has these Four Noble Truths, and he says the first of those Four Noble Truths is the truth of suffering. The noble truth of suffering. He did not say that life is suffering. It's fairly common to find in popular literature the idea that the Buddha taught that life is suffering. He did not say that. He just stated that there is suffering. And you kind of hard to deny that. Even if you say, I don't suffer, you still, to say there's no suffering, you just look around a little bit. And it's there. So there is suffering, and there's some noble possibility. There's a possibility in that suffering. But we have to stop long enough to pay attention to that suffering, to study it, to get to know it. And that is one of the great challenges of Buddhism, is a challenge to really tune in to the places where, when there's stress, tension, suffering. What is this? What's going on? To look at it. Then, the part of this Dharma door of suffering, as we study it, is to begin appreciating, seeing our contribution to that suffering. So not just simply seeing suffering in and of itself, but to see what am I doing to contribute to it. Specifically, especially to your own suffering. So if you found yourself suffering, what is your contribution? The idea being that the path of practice in Buddhism is found when you begin searching and understanding your contribution to it. Again, this is not very popular. You know, it's much better to blame someone else and assign the responsibility elsewhere. But again, remember, I'm talking about this as an adult path, which requires some degree of looking at your own contribution. It in no way meant to deny that other people are conditions for our suffering, that other people do awful things to each other, and that somehow we have to also contend and deal with those other people that are doing terrible things at times. We have to respond to them. Buddhists are not just supposed to sit, you know, on their cushion and deal with their own thing without responding. But the path of Buddhism is found by looking at our own contribution. And the perhaps radical, or maybe not radical, it was radical, but maybe a very challenging teaching of the Buddha is the teaching that our own suffering has its origins in our clinging. So in terms of where our contribution is, our responsibility is, it lies in our clinging. And so some people get insulted by this idea or really troubled by this idea. What? I'm suffering and you're telling me that I'm clinging? You know, my boss just fired me. Or I just got this terrible health diagnosis and I'm suffering terribly. And now you're telling me I'm suffering because I'm clinging? Horrible things happen to people and they suffer. And now you're telling me that it's not the horrible thing, it's I'm clinging? I mean, it's bad enough that I have this horrible health diagnosis, you know, it looks like I have, you know, a week left to live. And that's bad enough, and now you're rubbing salt in the wound by telling me that I'm suffering because I cling? Well, we have to be very careful who we tell this to. Because it could be like salt in a wound. It could actually be very difficult at certain times to hear this. Someone just lost their spouse, just died, and they're suffering terribly, tremendous grief. You go up to them, oh, you're just clinging. There might be a lot of clinging involved. There might be in that kind of situations. But you don't make it worse for people that way. But even so, the path in Buddhism involves looking at, sooner or later, having the ability to look in some deep way at the way in which our clinging, the consequences of our clinging, to see how clinging always produces suffering. If you let go of the clinging, the suffering that clinging produced is let go of as well. So this is my rewording of the Four Noble Truths. I think it's a little more palpable for people. Gill's first noble truth is, if you cling, you'll suffer. Actually, Gill has two noble truths. If you cling, you'll suffer. If you let go of that clinging, that suffering will go away, fall away. So it's really another way of saying the Four Noble Truths. So the Buddha said it this way. He said, there is suffering. That suffering arises from our clinging. And then the third noble truth is if you let go of, he didn't say, if that clinging ceases, if that clinging comes to an end, then the suffering comes to an end as well. So the Dharma door. So what? Where is the suffering? Having the ability to stop and be present for it. And I would suggest that in some situations, it's a long-term goal to have the personal ability to stop and really be present in an equanimous way for our suffering. I'm not saying it's easy. And a lot of the practices of mindfulness, of loving kindness, of compassion, of developing concentration and inner strength that Buddhism focuses on, is so that partly so we have the ability to stop and notice our suffering without reacting to it, without being for or against it, just being present in a full way, in our, with our consciousness, with our presence. Here it is. Because we tend to react so quickly to it. We tend to muddy the water, agitate our vision of it by our judgments, our reactions, our fears and everything. So it's a big endeavor just to do the first noble truth. And then, once we have that ability to be still enough, be equanimous enough with the suffering, then we can begin probing and looking, where is the clinging here? Am I clinging to comfort? Am I clinging to security? There's nothing wrong with comfort and security, but clinging to it will surely produce suffering. And sometimes security is a good goal to have, but sometimes it's overdone. Sometimes comfort is a nice thing to have, but the desire for it is overdone. Sometimes it's overdone when, for example, with comfort and sensual pleasure, when people define the success of their life by the degree of pleasure that they have. So there's some people who believe that something's fundamentally wrong with themselves if their life is not filled with pleasure and delight or success. For better or worse, the model of a spiritual practitioner in Buddhism is a monastic. Someone who has renounced many of the creature comforts, many of the sources of security, many of the sources of identity that many of us think is so essential for our lives. What is essential? What do we really need to have? And the big challenge of Buddhism is, do we need to cling to any of it? And so this is where the challenge begins. This is where the arguments begin. And I think it's healthy for Buddhist practitioners to be arguing with the Dharma, arguing with these teachings. And to say, wait a minute here. With this clinging, I understand this clinging stuff a little bit, but now I'm being told that I'm not supposed to cling to security, or to a sense of self, or to, you know, go on and on and on. What's that about? I don't believe that. This is really important. This is essential. I won't exist unless I have this. I cling to this. And so I think it's healthy to be in the debate, as long as you're a respecting debate partner. As long as you're willing to kind of hear the other side and engage and question, mostly in your own mind. So what is it we cling to? So sensual pleasure, comfort, security. One of them, a very powerful one in Buddhism, in Buddhist teachings, is the idea that we cling to a sense of self. So that has to do with ways we define ourselves, identities we have for ourselves, ways we protect ourselves. Even something as subtle as this wonderful, for some people, spiritual kind of sense of I am. I am. You don't feel, you don't say I am, you know, whatever. Just I am. This wonderful sense of I am. I am that I am, said the burning bush. The I am in Buddhism is, the Buddha said, even that sense of I am that contains a little bit of clinging in it. So that's odd. What's that about? So what does it mean to let go of clinging to self? And how thoroughly are people willing to do it? Is a challenge. Some people cling not so much to self, but they cling to existence. They want to exist. That a sense of I am-ness. And some people cling to the opposite. Some people have a very deep clinging. It's kind of an aversive clinging. Clinging to not existing. Not wanting to be. And that can take, you know, kind of silly forms. For example, a little bit maybe. But for example, no one should model themselves on me too much, but so as with that warning, I'll tell you something about myself. Since I was really young, I do not want to wear clothes that has any kind of emblem or sign or paintings or anything on it, because I don't want to be identified by anything. And so I've kind of, in the past, clung to that. It's been a kind of a clinging, identity, kind of a non-identity clinging. I don't want to exist that way. And so, you know, and it wasn't some wise thing. It's like, you know, keep away from me. You know, I don't want to be defined by anybody that way. And I've lightened up on that quite a bit. But you don't see me too often with something like that. So that's an example of, you know, clinging to a subtle form of non-existence. In extreme form, suicide would be a clinging to non-existence in Buddhism, and everything, a lot of things in between. So there's a lot of things we cling to. And the very promising teachings of the Four Noble Truths is the Third Noble Truth, which says that it's possible to cease, to bring to an end the clinging. And it's a little bit odd that one of the world's great religions should have one of its highest, most lofty goals, the ceasing of clinging. That seems like doesn't seem like much. I mean, my neighbors down the street, I mean, they have communion with God, they have oneness with the universe, they have, you know, all these wonderful, powerful experiences, infinite bliss. And they ask me, what do you have in your religion? You know, I let go of clinging. And it's okay, they say, you know. It's okay, we live in a pluralistic society, it's okay. If you have a sense of how pervasive and profound and deep clinging is in the heart, and have some intuition of what it means to unshackle, to release the heart totally and completely, at least from a Buddhist point of view, it's really the ultimate thing, ultimate experience, ultimate kind of thing to happen to a human being. And Buddhism tends not to talk a lot about what that's like to have that kind of level of release, the internal experience of having that level of release. But it's probably almost fair enough to call that experience of grace, profound, deep grace as a result. But that would be a very un-Buddhist thing to say, so I won't say it. It's a wonderful thing. So then the fourth noble truth, so there's four noble truths. And the fourth noble truth is the truth of the Eightfold Path, or the path. And here the idea is that it's pretty easy to point to suffering. It's pretty easy to say that suffering comes from clinging. And it's pretty easy to say, well, just let go of it and you'll be fine. It's hard to do it. We're dealing with the deep structures of our psychology, deep structures of our thought, deep structures of our emotional life, deep structures of who we think we are. And some of these deep structures are deeply formed by our conditioning as children. So we're dealing with very, very deep conditioning. And from a Buddhist point of view, some of these deep structures come with being born. They're just there, kind of the structures of the psyche. And so in order to have some chance to really get down and look at these things and really begin doing the deep work of letting go, there needs to be a path. There needs to be a process to do that. And so the Buddha then has this, the fourth noble truth is the process by which that's done. And so very briefly, the process begins with the first step called right view, right orientation. And that is to have the orientation that what we're trying to do here is the first three noble truths. So we understand that we're orienting ourselves around using suffering as a door, to use clinging as a door, non-clinging, and to use the release, that we're looking for that in our experience. So say that you find yourself here, you know, it rains, so it's raining, you realize you didn't bring your raincoat, and the thought arises, oh no, I'm supposed to be mindful. And now all these mindful people are going to see that I wasn't so mindful this morning when I left my house. And so it shows that I'm a poor mindfulness practitioner. And so this, I feel kind of depressed now. What are people going to think about me? And I'm kind of, you know, I've been doing this for a long time and I just failed and I'm kind of a bad person. And I think maybe I need to do some therapy. But I don't have enough money to go to therapy, and I never seem to have enough money, and I seem to squander it on video games, and I keep making these bad choices in my life, and these bad choices, you know, have to do with how my parents raised me, and I really need therapy to deal with this, and you know, and so go on and on and on. That's one way to go on. And that way to go on just adds suffering on top of suffering on top of suffering. Another way to go on is to look at yourself, think, oh, here I am, I notice it's raining, I'm thinking about how I don't have a raincoat, and I'm suffering in thinking about it. What's that suffering about? Oh, suffering is about because I'm clinging to how a group of people are going to see me. I think most people, if they clearly, with very clear cognizance of the fact that they're concerned how other people see them, interpret them, judge them, over a raincoat, will probably begin lightening up on that clinging. I hope. It's not a big deal. It's, oh, there it is again, that old habit of mine to measure myself, compare myself to others, and be concerned with what other people think about me. There it is. This is a relatively minor issue, raincoat issue. I think I can let go. And maybe you're able to let go. And that letting go, you feel the relief. You're no longer concerned with what people think about. And you walk out into the rain in your shirt. So that's one possibility. So that's a relatively, hopefully, a minor issue. It gets, you know, much more difficult when it's bigger issues in our life. Issues having to do with our relationships or work or what the purpose of our life is about. And so it takes a lot of care to investigate, to be present, to question, to be settled enough to do this kind of work. But what it requires is it takes an interest to look at our experience from this vantage point. Where is the suffering? Where is the clinging? Where is the release? There are other things you can do in a situation. The raincoat situation, you can, rather than thinking, well, the spiritual task is to look for suffering, you might think, well, the spiritual task is to realize that I am one with the universe right now. My spiritual task is to fall back into is to kind of pump up my concentration and get blissed out. And then I won't notice that people are judging me. It won't be an issue. So let's get the samadhi going. Let's get the joy going. So those are other tasks people could take. But those are orientations that don't lead to the end of suffering. So the suggestion is that if you are interested in this path, you find the path by beginning to be sensitive to where is the stress, where is the suffering, and where is the clinging, where is the release of it. It's beginning taking responsibility for this. And then the next seven steps of the Eightfold Path have to do with what you do in relationship to having seen suffering. The second of the Eightfold Path, right intention, has to do with once you see the suffering, see the clinging, then you're really kind to yourself about it. You try to evoke as much kindness and compassion as you can. So your attitude about what you see and how you are in this process is important. Rather than berating yourself or being hard on yourself because you're clinging and because you're suffering, the task is to kind of engage in this path with as much kindness and compassion as you can evoke. Maybe initially you can't evoke very much, but you try to find it for yourself. And that's why we're going to focus some of this year on loving kindness here at IMC. You might want to come to Shaila's class. And then with that, that's kind of the backdrop of how your attitude, at least an attempted attitude, then you try to work on your behavior. Try to have behavior behave in such a way that it helps you to be settled enough to look deeply into the structures of your clinging, structures of your mind. So if you want your behavior to help you be settled, You want to look at how you speak. Speech is a major, for people, a major source of agitation, one way or the other. And so the Buddha said, if you could look a little bit, be mindful of how you speak, and try to speak in such a way that you speak honestly and kindly and truthfully, so that you have a better chance of being settled, being relaxed, not saying things and causing things to happen through speech that agitate you and other people. The next one is that you want to behave in such a way that your ethics doesn't also agitate you. The idea being that if you go around killing, stealing, and lying, and doing sexual misconduct, it's going to be hard to be settled, to be calm. It's going to be hard to clean the windows of the mind so you can see what's going on there. If the mind is agitated, you can't see. So one of the reasons for ethics in Buddhism is not some moralism, but rather one of the reasons for ethics is that it's through being ethical that you have a fair chance to be calm enough, settled enough, still enough to see deeply into your psyche. And then you want to live, have a livelihood that is conducive for this practice at all. A livelihood which doesn't also agitate you. A livelihood that supports this process of deep looking, deep settling, deep release. So the first of the Eightfold Path is right orientation, right view. The second of the Eightfold Path is right intention. The next is right speech, right ethics, and then right livelihood. The last three have to do with looking and developing your own mind. So rather than behavior, now we're beginning to look into our mind. And it's hard to look into our mind. You have to be relatively calm and still to really begin looking deeply. And that's one of the reasons for meditation, is to have that calmness. And sixth of the Eightfold Path has to do with beginning to take some responsibility for what our mind does. Rather than letting our mind do whatever it wants, it has to do with beginning to, in easy ways at first, letting go of activities of our mind which cause us unhealth, are unhealthy for us, and start engaging in those activities of mind which are healthy for us. So if you spend a lot of time in your mind being critically judgmental of others or critically judgmental of yourself, it's not so hard to see that's unhealthy. If you spend a lot of time in your mind tuning into how beautiful people are and being kind and generous to people, that produces a different effect in the mind. It's more healthy. So in shorthand, this sixth step is beginning to take some responsibility for what goes on in your mind, changing the direction of your mind a little bit, to the degree that you can. The seventh and eighth have to do mostly with meditation practice. It's developing mindfulness practice, developing your mindfulness, and then the last one is developing your concentration, developing a stillness. And then with enough presence, calm, mindfulness, and concentration, we begin kind of finding the places of release, finding the Dharma doors of freedom where we can let go. Any degree of letting go, healthy letting go, feels good. If it doesn't feel good, you probably haven't let go properly. And I had that problem where I thought I was letting go at one point. And I found that I went around being kind of grumpy or kind of just kind of neutral. And then later it came back to bite me. And I realized that I hadn't let go properly. And one of the principles I have is that if there isn't some sense of joy or well-being in the letting go, I probably haven't let go of the right thing. Or haven't let go fully enough, completely enough. So each step along the way hopefully is satisfying. Each step on the path, each engagement in mindfulness practice and practice of Buddhism, I hope that people find it satisfying. Because I know some people hear about the great path and the deep structures of the mind we eventually get to address and think it's far off in the distance and get discouraged. And there is a path that is deepening and deepening. But there's something very significant that can be encountered and met each moment. Each moment, there's a door to freedom. There's a door of lightening up. Each moment, there's a door to let go of a little bit of clinging. It doesn't have to be dramatic to be beneficial. So, here as we begin our new year, I tell you that you will encounter in the course of this year an infinite number of Dharma doors. There is a surplus, an abundance. There is Dharma doors that will come your way every day. I hope you find some of them and step through them. Thank you.